Conversations That Matter is a partner program for the Center for Dialogue at Simon Fraser University. The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of the following and viewers like you.
James Hogan, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You have a very interesting book here, I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse. And I think we're seeing it unfolding in a way that we haven't seen, well, ever. What's at the heart of why we're having so much trouble communicating?
You know, that may be too big a question for me. But I'm a public relations guy of 30 years, and I've always been kind of interested in how people in my business go about doing what they're doing, including, you know, trying to get better myself, professional development, and so on. And I've, you know, over the years struggled with a lot of clients and ethical challenges that certain industries and companies have, or, reputational problems that they face. And early on in my career, myself and the many of the people I worked with in my agency, we would see this. We would get a phone call from a tobacco company wanting us to represent them in a lawsuit against or some person suffering from cancer who's bringing a lawsuit against them. And so we'd struggle with, are those the kind of people we want to represent? Is that the kind of argument we want to make? What's going to happen to our reputation if we take on this big reputational problem that this industry has? So early on, I decided that the issues management and crisis management business that I was in, the public relations business that I was in, was ultimately a character test. And that the best way to have a good reputation, to develop and maintain a good reputation, is you do the right thing, then you work to be seen to be doing the right thing, and you don't mix those two up.
Well, then you don't have to spin anything.
Yeah, and it's not like, we don't have differing opinions, or, we don't have to make strong assertions or convince people or persuade and so on. That's, I think, an important part of my business is the kind of passionate kind of debate and conversation. But more and more, we have industries that have a lot of trouble with their products. The oil and gas industry, the coal industry, the fossil fuel industry, its products are warming the planet. Just think of if you were the CEO of a company like that, how difficult it would be to defend the reputation of your organization. And so there is more and more people in my business, in the public relations business, who have started to think that when they can't win an argument, that the best thing to do is attack the integrity of the people who are disagreeing with you. So whether it's David Suzuki or, Al Gore or, the National Academy of Sciences in the United States, these folks are under attack because they're talking about what scientists are finding about climate change.
Well, I think that if we looked at Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, they probably elevated that line of attack to an art form that had been unseen. And it's as though they started to set a standard and many other people have fallen in behind it. And it doesn't seem to matter what the issue is. Like you, so therefore, or I don't like what you stand for, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take one element of what you say, I'm going to distort it, and then I'm going to attack the distortion. And now I create a debate.
Yeah, and if you're not making a mistake and stumbling, I'll make one up for you. And, I interviewed Noam Chomsky for my book. And Chomsky said, the technique is this. If you're having difficulty with an argument, you're on the wrong side of an issue, shriek, call people names, attack them personally. Do anything that you possibly can to raise hell so that you don't actually have to deal with an argument that you're having a lot of difficulty making. Mm-hmm. And so I think what we're seeing is a lot of that. And I think you're right that it is something that has been developing. And I just see it more and more. And certainly it's not just in the environmental world. When I was writing my book, I was concerned about environmental issues and how people could sort of just, keep ignoring it, you know, and or how it would be that people, you know, a bunch of political operatives could win a debate with legitimate scientists when they had no science on their side, very little credibility on their side, against people who had virtually all the science on their side and credibility. And, you know, if you look at the debate about climate change over the past 15 years or so, that's kind of the history of it. And so that puzzled me. But when I started writing the book, what I realized is you're having the same things happen if you're looking at things like immigration in the United States, if you're looking at gun control, whether you're looking at some, you know, use of pesticides.
Homophobia, whatever it is.
Yeah. And there's just a kind of a nastiness, and it's way beyond just being uncivil or not following Marcus of Queensbury rules in public debate. This is basically an attempt to take issues and change the meaning of them so that you can no longer have a debate about the right and wrong of something, because the issue becomes something, once these people have finished playing with it, the issue has become something that people like you and I don't believe this. And if you do believe this, you can't be one of us. You must be one of them.
Well, that's another part that's come into this. You know, in your book, you cite the fact that we're living more and more isolated lives. We're interconnecting to the world through the internet, but people aren't really seeing us. And so we're feeling emboldened to say, I don't like that, or you're an idiot, or that's a dumb idea, as though somehow that's going to move us forward. And it's happening more and more. I can't help but think, if we take a look at the model of Dick Cheney, who was so devastating in his attacks on people, we go, well, he was the Vice President of the United States, he could get away with that. And now we're seeing it being magnified in the embodiment of Donald Trump, to the point where people are feeling emboldened to say just whatever they feel, as though somehow that's okay. But I don't know where that gets us in developing anything. And so when your book came along, I thought, oh my gosh, this is exactly the malaise that we're living in right now.
That's right. And the problem, I think the problem is that when the general public looks at issues and what they see is extreme polarization, where it looks like you have people on both sides thinking the other side
is wrong,
are idiots, or wrongdoers, mm-hmm. evil, they become even more despairing about whether or not you can actually do something about these difficult problems that we face. And so I think that people who use these techniques to polarize issues and basically shut people's thinking down. So what happens, one of the guys I interviewed was a very interesting social psychologist and a moral psychologist named Jonathan Haidt. And he said that human beings are designed by evolution to unite into teams, to divide against other teams, and be blinded from the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens when you tribalize issues, then open-minded thinking shuts down. And it happens on both sides. It's mm-hmm. not just the right, it's also the left. When somebody disagrees with our tribe or the beliefs of our community,
mm-hmm.
we're very defensive about it. And the more we're attacked, the more we defend.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of what we see today is like that. You know, it may start with ad hominem attacks, but eventually you tribalize the issues. I mean, people who advocate, I think, you know, thank God for advocates,
mm-hmm.
but there is a trap in advocacy. Because you, even though you may have the facts on your side, you start to disagree with somebody, and maybe you do it in public, and then they start to disagree back with you. All of a sudden, it's not just that they're wrong, they become a wrongdoer. And then before you know it, after a while, it's you're David and they're Goliath.
And you're attacking one another, right?
That's right. It's a fight between good and evil, and defeating the person who's disagreeing with you and humiliating and... You know, and steamrolling them becomes more important to you than the actual issue that you
started. Because it becomes personal.
Exactly. It's personal, and it's emotional, and it's very. And these forces are just as powerful in human beings as Carol Tavris told me. She wrote a book called Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me. A really interesting social psychologist. And she said, these forces of self-justification are every bit as powerful as thirst and hunger. And so you end up having these arguments that actually aren't about the evidence. They're not really a debate. Mm-hmm. And so all of this kind of bluster that you see is not, it's not like overdoing the debate. The debate's not even happening. Mm-hmm. We've actually eliminated, we don't even have the space anymore for the conversation or the debate.
Right. You know, you were talking about how people separate into tribes and they stop being able to hear the truth. And I'm reminded of a quote from Nazi Germany about Hitler, who apparently had said, and it's terrifying to hear this and to quote Hitler, "I lie to them because they want me to."
That's right. We want to be misled. So you, because it reaffirms the belief system. And so, and I think it's particularly true when what you believe is really false, because false beliefs, you have to be, it's like a full-time job to deny the information that is sort of invading your set of false beliefs. And so when you and your team, it's called motivated reasoning, where you're sort of selectively looking for information that just reinforces what it is that you already believe, that is a form of denial, where mm-hmm. you basically, you don't want to be open to being challenged, because people like to think of themselves as smart and good and above average and not the kind of person who, you know, would be the way what they're being accused of, right? And so there's strong kind of emotional and psychological responses mm-hmm. that we're seeing at play here. You know, so once people like me start to figure out a way that they can tribalize issues, you lose. The debate and the issue loses, and we all lose.
Yeah.
The reasonableness goes out of it.
Well, I found it interesting that you had interviewed George Lakoff, whom I have interviewed in the past, and I think that he's an extraordinary linguist and provides tremendous insight into how you can be so easily manipulated through right. framing and metaphors.
Right.
And so you add that into the mix, you get people, and it doesn't matter what side of the equation they're on or the argument that they're on, if they know what they're doing and how to evoke that emotional response that is going to, like, you know, fire up your buttons, how do you as the average person combat that or start to understand where the truth is?
Yeah, I know, and I. But for me, I kind of part of the way through the book, you know, when I started the book, I was thinking about this problem outside of myself, right? So I was sort of thinking of it as a problem in the public square, and me being, you know, someone who's sort of an observer and a small participant in this. But as I kept talking to people, you know, talked to the Dalai Lama, talked to another lot of spiritual and kind of moral leaders, I started to realize that something Peter Senge said to me, the quality of an intervention is determined by the inner quality of the intervener. And I kept hearing that in that lesson in different ways. You know, take the board out of your own eye before, you know, you take the sliver out of somebody else's. Karen Armstrong said to me, you know, remember what St. Paul said, charity takes no delight in the wrongdoing of others. And, you know, somebody else said to me, you know, you should remember you too could be unknowingly under the influence of bias. You could be wrong. And so I start to think like, whoa, you know, so it's not like I'm some kind of innocent observer in this whole thing, right? Mm-hmm. And I started to look at that part of it and realizing that even if you do have the facts on your side, even if you know that what you believe that what your position is the morally right position, it's a good idea to sort of hold your beliefs lightly and to try, even if people don't deserve it, to, in your mind, mm-hmm. to assume that people are well-meaning and that they're not evil. Because I don't think most people are evil. I mean, there may be some really bad, you know, there's Dick Cheney's around, and we can't be stupid.
Right.
But at the same time, I don't think most people are like that.
I agree with you.
And so I think if you can kind of show someone that you're kind of willing to be open to what it is that kind of questions your views and mm-hmm. maybe respects theirs a bit, then I think the conversation can start as opposed to it just being kind of a gridlock.
I'm reminded, I saw Bill Clinton speak here back in 2001, shortly after 9/11, and he was talking about the nature of truth. And he said, you know, most of us organize our lives in silos. You know, I'm a man, you're a woman, I'm a lawyer, you're a doctor, I'm this, you're that, I'm a liberal, you're a conservative, and so on. And he says, so we've got all these silos. And he says, why do we do that? We do it because it makes it easier for us to navigate the lives that we've created for ourselves. He said, but then there's all this other stuff that's in and around those silos, between them, above them, and below them. And in that is the richness of life, and you start to be able to understand other perspectives and broaden your own horizons. But oh my gosh, is it ever hard to do? Like, I started this show for that very reason. I went, well, I actually want to talk to people. I don't want to hear sound bites. I don't want to hear spin. I want to talk to people, and I want to talk to them from different perspectives. When I talk to somebody who's on one side of the spectrum on an issue, all of a sudden I get people over here telling me you're too soft on them, or you shouldn't have them on your show, and then the other way around. And so, as you pointed out, everybody has this challenge. How do I open myself up and listen to someone else? It's tricky.
And it's very, for particularly somebody like me, I think I'm a particularly good example of the problem that I...
How so?
Well, I think I'm, I mean, I started a blog called G-Smog Blog that kind of goes after people who are trying to misinform the public, in my view, about climate science. Most people are not going to spend the amount of money and time that I've spent on that project. And you invest in it, right? And I think that, you know, my experience over the last little while has been really quite interesting because I've been doing all these radio shows in the States. So I'll sit at home in my office in Salt Spring, and I'll be on the show waiting to be interviewed. And this one, about a month and a half ago, all of a sudden an ad came on, and it was, yes, and Glenn Beck will be on in an hour and a half. Blah, blah, blah. You can ask him. And I thought, what the hell kind of radio show is this? So it turns out it's like a, you know, rolling into work, right-wing radio show, like highly partisan. And I thought, whoa, this is probably not going to go very well for me. And so these two guys just peppering me with these questions. And we got along fantastic because they agreed that we have basically polluted the public square to the point where you can't have a healthy debate.
Yeah.
And so I thought, wow, that's a huge step forward. For me, it was like a big lesson, you know, that it's not just the, you know, people, you know, I don't consider myself a left of center person. I'm concerned about environmental issues, so people assume I am. But, I mean, I've been a corporate PR guy for far longer than I've been on the board of the David Suzuki Foundation. And so, you know, maybe I'm a little bit more open to right-wing type of ideas. But I think that spending time with people that you really disagree with, deeply disagree with, is probably a thing we should be looking for.
Well, a friend of mine said to me, she said, what's the point of hanging out just with people who agree with you all the time? How are you ever going to learn anything new?
Right.
She said, you're better off going locking horns with somebody who goes, you're full of it. They force you to learn new aspects of your own argument as well as look at life from a different perspective. And you're just saying that's exactly what's happening to you.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And so there was a point in, there are two things that happened, two interesting, I don't know how much time we have left, but do we have enough time?
4 or 5 minutes.
Yeah. Okay, well, just two quick stories. There were big lessons for me in the book. So David Suzuki and Gregor Robertson and I, a couple of years ago, spent an afternoon at UBC with a Vietnamese Zen Buddhist monk named Thich Nhat Hanh. And he's very famous in Buddhist circles around the world, and he was a very good friend of Martin Luther King's. He's in his early 80s, but sharp as a tack. And we were sitting down talking, and he was saying to Suzuki and I and to Gregor that we needed to bring meditation into our work with environmental issues. And so I said, you're not saying we shouldn't be activists. You know, that David Suzuki shouldn't be an activist, are you? I mean, Canadians expect him to, you know, have a strong voice and stick up for the environment. And he looked at me and he said, speak the truth, but not to punish. And I remember thinking, whoa, it was like somebody punched me in the solar plexus. I thought, whoa, like, wow, that. And then I'm, as we were walking off the stage afterwards, because it was a small audience there, my wife was in the front row and she said, you heard what he said, right? Speak the truth, but not to punish. And I, you know, I think there's an enormous lesson in that. Certainly there is for me.
Yeah.
That it's great that we have these debates and disagreements and that we participate in democracy. The last thing we want is people not to care, not to get involved. But we have to be really careful in the way that we treat people who are on the other side of the argument, because there are ways that if we're too aggressive that we can actually undermine the very democracy that we're trying to participate in.
Right.
So to me, I think it was a great... Now, so the other one was with the Dalai Lama. And I was in Dharamsala, and we had just had this great conversation. And we're standing up at the end of the interview, and somebody shut the TV camera off. And he reached over and tried to touch my forehead with his finger. And he said, we like to think the Western mind is more sophisticated. But I think... But he said, oh, in Tibet, we operate from the heart. And I think that may be stronger. Mm-hmm. Maybe if we take the Western mind and the Tibetan heart together, we can start to deal with some of these problems.
Now, your next book is How Do We Move to One of Reconciliation or Being Able to Get Along?
Yes. So that's a little bit, you know, I think a good starting point is assuming that people who disagree with you are well-meaning.
And I couldn't agree with you more. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
Yeah.